providing a framework by which we can actually work together and have a robust community intervention plan is actually critical to the way in which we can tackle this growing problem. One of the major issues that we've looked at recently as well, and we had a male in Perth here in Australia sentenced on a Friday for trying to sell a domain name registrar database. The impact that could have had on the stability of the internet is actually fairly significant, as most people here in the room can understand. Now, the next slide that I'll just show up is actually a movie clip from Ice Age 2. When you actually see it, just have a think about the process of what we all want to take out the best of the internet. As we do that, we can start to see some holes that appear, some of the threats and trends that come up. We can do our best to try and block those holes, block those threats, but in the end, if we're spread too thinly, there's a chance that it's going to be a long and hard fall for us all.
Thank you very much. It's very hard to smile quite so hard and pass on to Nigel. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Cheryl. Let's see if I can make this work. Thank you very much. Great stuff. Well, you've heard an introduction. Seems like I've been around ICANN forever, like before there was an ICANN. I've got professional interests that are both in the internet and IT business and in the law. Now, there are lots of lawyers in ICANN, and they tell me the only thing worse than a lawyer turned geek is geek turned lawyer. We're going to talk about DNS abuse, and what I thought I'd do is just give a few little highlights, a little keynote, if you like, pose more questions and give answers, and then hopefully we can tease out some things in the discussion. Which will provide some answers, perhaps, but more likely possible routes to further questions even. The three categories I've put them in are illegality, unlawfulness, and antisocial behaviour. There's a shameless plug here for a famous ICANN person. If you know Kieran McCarthy, he wrote a book called Sex.com, which was about stealing a domain name. So if you haven't come across this case before, run, do not walk, and buy this book. Fraud, misleading names used in phishing, we've heard quite a bit about that already today, and so on. But the key point that I see in the criminality is plain old crime just done with the help of a domain name. Unlawfulness, there's a couple of examples that perhaps people haven't thought of. Rights infringement right at the bottom is very, very familiar. It seems we've been talking about trademark and IP rights forever. And a couple of others. A domain name could actually commit a libel in itself. It's a string. For you to say Nigel Roberts is a burglar.com, I assure you I'm not, therefore it's a libel. Database mining, that's a famous case of an attempt not too far from here, I think, to use the Whois to enumerate Nominate's database. I won't say too much about antisocial behaviour, but I define that as activities that are actually perfectly legal, but in some societies are considered undesirable. To some people, warehousing and domaining could, at some point, be abuse of the DNS. Here's an interesting one that perhaps we haven't thought of. Free expression, something that in both the United States and in Europe we hold dear. And that could even actually be entirely illegal in some societies. Here's a problem. Do you disclose registry data to law enforcement in a totalitarian country whereby they're trying to track down, for example, who's using mobile phones and the internet to get information out from, for example, a country where something is happening right now? So why do we have detailed who is data globally accessible? That is one of the questions I think ICANN's been wrestling with for several years. And the only thing I would say at the end of this particular slide is that policies, considerations and remedies vary wildly from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. There is a discontinuity between attitudes both within the US and within the US and Europe, let alone many, many other societies that are out there. So we're going to talk about law enforcement and the CCTLDs. I've kind of deliberately interpreted this in two ways. What are the CCTLD managers' responsibility for enforcement of the law? And what is the CCTLD's relationship with law enforcement agencies, which is perhaps the more obvious meaning of this panel? Well, CCTLD managers are not law enforcement agencies. In fact, we are not and should not be a substitute legislature, and the same goes for ICANN, a substitute of the executive branch. We are not law enforcement agencies, and we certainly shouldn't be a substitute for the judicial branch. But there is a positive obligation on all of us to protect the rights and freedoms of others in our societies. Things like a right to private life, but including the right to be protected from criminal activity. So it's my submission to the panel here today that it's a CCTLD manager's positive obligation, irrespective of whether it's public or private sector, to work with appropriate agencies, whoever they may be in your country or in other countries, towards the goal of protecting people. How to improve that? Well, it might sound obvious, but you can just talk. You can pick up the phone. Police agencies, for example, have very, very different levels of expertise. We're very fortunate that we meet here in ICANN some of the best. There are others that you can have difficulties with. I remember when the tsunami happened and there was an issue in England with something to do with the disaster emergency. There was basically a fishing site that we, you know, I got a spam about a fishing site. I was just a citizen, and trying to deal with the Essex police at the time was actually quite difficult because the expertise was concentrated in one particular little place, and finding that officer was several days just to find the officer. So, but as CCTLD managers, perhaps we should consider the environment in which LEAs operate. In the Mexico meeting, something very, very interesting came out, at least from my perspective, is that I spent 5 years simply not understanding why law enforcement agencies in, for example, the United States, were so keen on global, publicly available whois. And the penny finally dropped when it was realized that a mutual assistance request across jurisdictional borders can take months. So is there a way to square this circle? Now, I think there is. Now, in the context of a European CCTLD manager, there are obligations on all of us. So what we call conventional rights are, in some sense, very similar to United States constitutional rights. Right to private and family life I referred to earlier. But the right to free expression. There's also hard law, data protection law, and also laws enabling lawful access to various data, such as telephone and perhaps internet records as well. But what happens if you're dealing, if you're European CCTLD, and there are some good guys, and they're outside the EEA, and they want some data? How do you deal with that? Well, it is a balancing act. But I would suggest that disclosure of, for example, of registry data, it doesn't have to be just who is. The registry can be in possession of other data that is relevant to an investigation. It might be traffic data. It might be historical who is data. I'm trying to put this forward in a more technology-neutral fashion as possible. But this is the guideline that has to be followed in my submission, that it's got to be in accordance with law, necessary in a democratic society, and proportionate to the aim to be achieved. And that will probably sound quite familiar to some of you. I think it's quite possible to come up with an agreement between law enforcement agencies and CCTLD managers in the form of something like a memorandum of understanding, a bit like the contractual clauses recommended by the European Union for lawful transmission of personal data outside the EEA, for example, to United States or India. And the final question I'm going to leave you in this presentation, and maybe some of the audience or some of the other panel can have some suggestions on this, how would you put such an agreement together, and what might it comprise? Thank you for your time.
Thank you. We have thought up and down the table here for certain. Christmas thing.
Good afternoon again, everybody. I'm going to catch you up some more time, Cheryl.
Excellent.
I'm going to be very, very brief because I'm actually more interested in hearing what everyone else has to say. And you've all probably heard enough from me this week anyway.
Never.
I'll be very quick. So I just wanted to touch on the fact that what we do with our... If we're talking about who is, what we do with our who is data, our who is data is basically highly accurate. It's not disclosed past a certain point, registrant name, email address. But we have a series of protocols with various institutions that enables them to ask us for information, and we provide that information to them, provided they fill in the letter requesting it. So I think, to a degree, that actually deals. Whilst I accept that it's not very, might not be very helpful on cross-border, I think we can actually find a way around that. I think that actually deals with the balance between privacy and the need for information. My concerns about whether it's e-crime or... Is that why we're calling it e-crime? Everyone else calls it cybercrime. Is there some reason for that? The official government position?
We've lost the government.
Yeah. education, there's a lack of understanding about who's responsible for what. And that can mean that it can take quite a long time for stuff, as I think Anjali was saying, to find your right policeman. So we know what we're responsible for, and that doesn't mean that other people out there know what we're responsible for. So that's quite challenging. And I'll give you an example. We had one of Australia's largest banks is called National Australia Bank, and they're known quite commonly as the NAB, the NAB. The domain name nab.com.au, I got a phone call. This had taken 2 days for them these people to eventually get to me, because nab.com.au, which was being used, wasn't the National Australia Bank, and was being used for phishing. Now, the person who finally got to me from the National Australia Bank was extremely frustrated and very annoyed, and not surprisingly, and wanted something done immediately. He wanted the domain name immediately, so the website immediately removed and the domain name taken down, because clearly there couldn't possibly be a legitimate registration of the domain name. Now, it turns out that actually it was a legitimate registration of the domain name. It's some accountancy group in Western Australia who've had the domain name since 1997 or something, probably way before that, and the problem wasn't with them. The problem was simply that the people who were hosting them had been compromised, and that's why their website was being used for phishing. That took me about 15 minutes to fix. It took me about 5 minutes to work it out, another 10 minutes to fix. But it had been floating around for 2 days before anybody actually got to me. So my plea would be for us to talk to each other all the time and open up the lines of communication, not just in our own CCTLDs, but overseas, across borders, and actually introduce, just to take an example, introduce, the Australian Federal Police can introduce us to the FBI guys and you and so on. That's really all I wanted to say. Oh, I did want to say one other thing, which is actually, Steve, you listed up there as one of the domain name registrants, Donald Duck.
Yes,
actually, that's my partner's Jill Duck's uncle. No, it's true.
This is not a joke.
It's absolutely true. He was christened before Donald Duck was actually invented. So if he was into the internet and if he did have a domain name, he'd be in serious trouble now because you'd...
Indeed he would, and thank you for getting us back on track. Did you want a right of reply there, Steve? I'm happy to give you a right of reply. Delighted. Ladies and gentlemen, if you're not a native Spanish speaker, I would remind you to put your headphones on now, and that those who wish to listen in English will need to use Channel 1. Those who wish to listen in French will need to use Channel 2. And if you're perfectly happy with your Spanish, you don't need to use any channel at all, but that's normally on Channel 3. Eric, go ahead.
I prefer speaking English because my Spanish is very, very bad. But
First of all, I want to thank the translators because they are only translating for me, I guess. Nobody else had the headphones listening to Spanish. And then thank Eli Cantor that I can speak in my own language. You are invited to use the headphones here. The first thing we have to understand about the CCTLD in Latin America is that we have diverse origins. There are governmental CCTLDs. There are others which originate in civil societies. There are some that originate in universities, national universities, private universities. The second thing we have to understand that the relationship with our governments have been for CCTLDs, government CCTLDs have been complicated in most of the cases because they are in different offices. They sit in different offices. CCTLDs in some countries are under the Ministry of Communication, but in other countries, they don't have much contact with them. So we have to also understand that in Latin America, our countries have a democracy. They are young countries, and the relationship between civil society and university and government has been complicated. So how to work together with agency of law enforcement that are on the governmental side, and in the last years they're becoming trained, and they didn't have a training that we could have a good training to converse among each other. Last year we started a relationship with country code as a code with the law enforcement agencies. And this year we had a workshop of legal aspect which developed a handbook of operations for CCTLDs or how to relation with law enforcement agency. And last May we had a workshop with them and in Panama where we posed some questions, and I don't have those answers to those questions. I didn't have them at the time, but they can help us what's the problem behind this. One workshop has been carried out, and what we want to know in this is this domain name, xyz.com, whatever, or .p, just to as an example. What they wanted to know as a fact was what was the IP name behind it. They didn't want to know who was an owner of the domain name, because when you open, there was a name like Mickey Miles, a fantasy name, because these registries are allowed in the .p registry. So that detail was not important for them. It wouldn't be helpful in trying to follow up a current. It was helpful to know who paid for this because the credit card number is traceable, but that credit card has been cloned, so it was an illicit act which they couldn't identify. And the other identity, the number one they wanted is the IP. But in Latin America, some regulations, the IP number is a detail which is private, personal, and second is protected by the Secret in Communications Act. And the only way to lift it is through a judge, by order of a court. If you have a phishing case now, until the judge resolves, 1 month passed by, and everything has been lost, and the detectives are lost also. This is a very serious problem because, in fact, what the agency wanted is to find the IP numbers. And the detail they asked, the CCTLD said, we want the IP number. And they told them, if you want to know who is behind the IP, you go to the provider or to the hoster and find out who's got this number through the Whois. So they wanted access to the Whois tables directly. But it's free. You can access directly those tables of Whois, lists of Whois. You have to fill up the domain name you want, and you obtain the number. What did the law enforcement agency been doing? They were sending a letter through the secretary. They left the police, and while it arrived to the country code, many days passed by, and they were waiting a response, not by email, but through in paper. So one of the tools they used was that the contact address was to be validated on both sides so the information could be fluid. A very practical solution, but it saved law enforcement agency plenty of resources and plenty of paper to avoid downing trees. The other thing is that they decided they wanted details of the Whois. They wanted to know if the name of the Whois in the Whois is the one that it says. I can tell you the name I was asked to put in that place. So there was no agreement in this subject. It was said that the detail in or the information in Whois looks like it's like sworn registrations, like something that he's been finalized. When the law enforcement agency asked to be done, and all the others were in agreement to train from CCTLD, which has more training information and has security, has follow up, has more conflict resolution capabilities to the police agency. And they were interested in listening to the country code and not having them as an opponent. Because banks, when there was phishing involved, they sent letters. They said, you are accomplice in a phishing act. Help me because I have to find out who is doing the phishing here. And this is the concrete case of Venezuela, which was mentioned today. The country code of Venezuela is within the Ministry of Communications. So it's an office, a governmental office. Yeah, yeah. Thank you. The problem of country code in Venezuela was the agency of the domain names, to call it in a way. It was in a ministry different to the ministry where the police was located. And in order to cross, to do the crossing between agencies, they needed a mandate from a third agency. So it was a bureaucracy problem, if you want to put it in such a way. But also, the alert didn't arrive because somebody was accusing somebody, but it came through these companies that they are following up some special domain names like PenPal, Google, etc., and they alerted. This alert they sent was like a notice and take down, not little more than that. You've been advised that you this is happening, and if you don't take do something, we will take legal action. And in Latin America, these letters are laughed upon. Why? Because there's no legal way for a company, like a company in the United States, to act in another country protected by its own laws. So this is part of the agreement that started being done, carried out, that these companies, these agencies, started sending the letters with the word, please. Please, be as kind. Help us. Before you are being ordered to do something, to act against this, which was impossible, because they have contractual relations to protect, even if they can be invalidated because the name was Mickey Mouse. But second, there is a line of command, and the line of command said the police agency had to send the country code. This fluidity that has been discovered throughout the year has allowed us to conjugate actions between law enforcement agencies and country codes. And finally, two more reflections. The first one, in Latin America, we are preparing a series of handbooks, which we will be very, very pleased to provide to you. What happens if this dialogue doesn't happen? The second, the country code is based on a legislation, national legislation. This national legislation, at the moment, Latin America is working strongly in the development of certs, where those country codes are located, and in the protection of private data privacy, which is a legislation which is still pending in Latin America. This is a situation we have in the region. We are working in together. All together, and we still have many things to do. The solution was training, mutual training, and understanding that one is not the enemy of the other, but they are working on this, against the same enemy. Thank you.
Rob.
Thank you very much. Just a quick introduction to AusCert. It's a not-for-profit organization based at the University of Queensland. We're funded by member subscriptions, and that membership ranges from government, commercial organisations and educational institutions. We also receive some revenue from some very targeted government projects that we undertake, as well as running an annual conference every year. However, we try and look beyond the interests of our immediate members and try to help Australian internet users where possible and where practical for us to do so. We feel that if we can help increase the level of Australia's internet security posture or standards and make Australia an unfriendly place for online criminals to do business, then we'll try and do so. We're not a law enforcement agency. However, we do conduct significant amounts of incident response or incident response coordination. And we do that by just really asking nicely, and as Eric just said, we say please a lot. We also just rely on the fact that most hosting providers and infrastructure providers don't want malicious activity occurring on their infrastructure, and alert them to that fact. And in where practical, we try and educate as well. So just looking at the issue of who is, which has been discussed a little bit here. From our perspective, we often find this very useful for an incident response capacity because, and I'll give you a specific example that we've had dealt with numerous times, and that is web defacements. So that is when an attacker compromises a website and puts up, replaces the actual correct content with their own content, and often it's political messages or even just this is hacked by, you know, their hacker handle or something like it, of that nature. In that case, we often will contact the ISP, but ISP's abuse handling varies from organisation to organisation, and that can take hours or even days to resolve that issue. However, with up-to-date Whois data, we can actually, in some cases, have been able to call the registrant, and that means we've been able to inform them directly that their website's been compromised, and they then often take give that a high priority to rectifying that issue. So we're able to mitigate that incident or start responding to that incident very quickly. Just on some of the DNS abuse incidents or issues that we're dealing with, we've already had a lot of discussion already about phishing. And sorry, this is also specifically those incidents where domain names are being registered, so not specifically the hacked websites, but the domain names being registered. We've had a lot of discussion about phishing already, and for registrars to take these down, it's sometimes or often a fairly easy thing to do to say, okay, here's the legitimate website and here's this fake fraudulent, look, they're the same, it's infringing on that intellectual property or that trademark and used for malicious purposes, can you please take it down? There's also, which is, you know, quite a straightforward case to make. What's not so straightforward, and Steve mentioned this in his presentation, was the money mules, and they are the people who are recruited to actually be parts of the money laundering chain that once that bank account is compromised, then those money mules are used to actually launder that those funds offshore. It's very difficult for us to show a registrar, and a registrar is often quite rightly sceptical to say, well, why am I going to take what looks like what could well be a very legitimate company off the internet on your say-so? So that's a problem that we've struggled with significantly, and we the best we've sort of done is relied on our friends in the AHT or the AFP and the AHTCC to do a lot of that work for us, because we just have too much of a hard time trying to convince registrars to take those sites down. Both phishing and mules are often hosted on the fast flux infrastructure, and as Steve mentioned, that can cycling domain names through multiple IPs at a very quick rate. It's great to see ICANN's recent interest and research and fact-finding on the fast flux problem, and we hope that there's some good outcomes as a result of that, so that's good to see. Also, there's a more insidious issue that's often as well, again, for the purposes of financial fraud, is malicious software, and that's something we deal with quite a bit. And again, these domains are being registered, and we see them distributing malicious software, being the command and control structure, and obviously the example is Configure there, as well as domains that actually collect compromised personal information. So once that software on your computer has, or that malware on your computer has captured your username and password, it sends it off to one of these domains to be logged. And again, all those three situations are often quite difficult to convince registrars that they are actually a problem. And that's an ongoing challenge for us. But what we see, that is often a more significant problem than we see phishing, because it's so much more than just username and password credentials for bank accounts. It can be a whole raft of password protected or credentials for other sensitive internet sites. We also see some incidents involving distributed denial of service amplification attacks using DNS servers, but I won't go into those here in the interest of time, but I'm happy to speak about those later. And there's also the opportunity to perform poisoning type attacks of the DNS system. That's something that AusCert isn't seeing a lot of, but that's not to say that those attacks aren't occurring. Their very nature means that they could be occurring and no one's actually detecting those, or the DNS server provider might be just quietly fixing those incidents and not wanting to report them further. So they're the main, I guess, types of DNS abuses that we see. I just also, since this is a country code specific discussion, I'd also like to share what I think is a bit of a success story, and similarly to Afilius's initiatives with the .info.biz response changes, we saw in 2006 and 2007 significant targeting of the Hong Kong, the .hk domain space. And in those years, we saw 55 in 2006 and 81 in 2007 domains registered for these purposes of either phishing, Trojans, mules, or some other aspect of Trojans like command and control or logging sites. This is probably a underestimate, because this is more those sites involving Australian banks or institutions or all malware sites, so it's probably definitely on the underside. The Hong Kong DNR started cooperating with the Hong Kong CERT team, and they and our incidents significantly dropped off then. In 2008, there were three, and 2009, there's only been two. So I think that's a really a good success story, and I don't see that as being publicised widely, well, as widely as it could have been. So I just thought I'd share that with you, that that's something to consider, that if you, as CCTLDs, you might want to consider partnering with a trusted partner like a CERT or a law enforcement agency, and have them being able to vet some of these takedown requests that are coming through, and give you some certainty that you're not going to take down a legitimate domain. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. Chris, you wanted to have a word? Or?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about taking things down. Registrars actually can't do that. It's ISPs that can do that. So registrar, I mean, certainly in Australia, the registrar, the only thing the registrar can do is to either delete the domain name or stop the name servers, or take the name servers out. And if so, it's just a term that you just want to be clear about that. We have things we can do, but they actually sort of, when you talk about taking a site down, which is what you actually want, isn't it, rather than the domain name to be deleted.
Thanks for that clarification, but actually I'm talking about domain names being deleted, because in the case of FastFlux, for example, those or domains that have been specifically registered for the purposes of attacks. So, yes, I mean deleted in this case, so my apologies for that.
As opposed to taking...
Yeah, okay, fine.
Well, thanks for that clarification indeed. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm wondering if there's any questions with regard specifically to the CCTLDs and security. Yes? No? You're changing batteries? Questions? It was all perfectly well understood, and you're excited about what they're doing. I'd like to think that perhaps some of this a slowness that I see with the mix of paper and the need to say please, it sounds to me that there might be an opportunity for some of the CCs to share the combined wisdom of their experience at some point in the future. I'm wondering, Chris, perhaps with your chair of the CCNSO hat on, whether your constituency might want to think about something to do between now and Seoul.
See, now we almost got away. But you had to ask me a question, and now Bertrand stood up.
Chris, it's written here.
Yeah, I know. I know what it's. I know. I'm not actually clear. I understand what you're asking me to do.
Well, from what I heard here, there wasn't a whole lot other than learn to talk to each other and sharing of experiences that can be done right now in terms of cooperation.
That's right.
Is there an opportunity for us to perhaps look at something in Seoul where some of the CC experiences, where you've got better practice and worse practice, could be looked at? Yes, Eric?
Not exactly for the meeting, but the four regional organisations, LACTLD, APTLD, AFTLD and CENTER, are working very hard together to making trainings and workshops in one in ACRP for one size, and another size is about security and technical. Also, we are working together to try to involve more our CCTLDs in that kind of issues, but maybe it could be a good idea have in the CCNSO meeting. We can suggest that proposal.
And clearly, more regionalised focus would be the better way forward. Michael.
Michaela, you can get a right eventually, I'm sure. Okay. There's a couple of things. Nigel was talking about this memorandum of understanding concept. I mean, we've talked about it a bit elsewhere as well. And one of the questions that kind of sprang to my mind was, how would that affect the relationship between the registrars and the registry and the registrants? I mean, if it's all very well in the case of a registry operator which does not actually have any formal registrars, because obviously the registrant has a direct contract with the registry. But it also has the implication that you're changing part of the contract, because obviously if you introduce a memorandum of understanding, that's going to affect the existing domains that you have. And then if you're going to do that in a situation where you have both registrars and direct access as a kind of registrar of last resort type situation, how would you handle that?
It's got to be yours, Nigel, and then Chris.
Well, I think there's more than just me to answer this, but two things. The plan is for the MOU to be technology neutral. So first of all, what that means is we're not just talking about who is data, although that's clearly a large part of it. We're not also insisting in this concept that a registrar situation obtains. I mean, in our registry, we're a very thin, thick registry, or a very small, thick registry. We have all the data on all registrations in our TLD. The other thing is about, you mentioned contractual considerations. Our contractual terms and conditions, and they're available at www.channelisles.net if anybody wants to look at them, are already drawn in such a way that we may lawfully disclose data, but we are not compelled to. This is more about a situation whereby we document a lawful way that we can transfer data, if it's appropriate, to appropriate agencies outside of the European Economic Area. I mean, clearly, something within, let's say, the UK, if you're in the UK, Ireland, if you're in Ireland, anywhere within the EU will have a lawful disclosure law. But it's when you're going outside the EEA that you need something like this to make it lawful under data protection law. And it's very high level. I hope that answers the question. These are ideas. We're going slowly towards this.
I mean, the thing is, I think it's something that needs to be discussed further. I mean, I like personally...
That's why I brought it up.
We know. I mean, just the thing, from our perspective, speaking my capacity, I mean, as a hosting provider and registrar, it's obviously in our interest that, you know, that the domains are not abused, because that affects our business and everything else. But obviously, at the same time, we have to balance that with privacy and proper due process. Because the fear I would have is that you could end up in a situation, and somebody, I think it was the gentleman from Alcert, mentioned intellectual property rights infringements. And the thing is, where do you draw the line? Because the situation we've had in Ireland in the last 6 to 8 months is where the Irish equivalent of the RIAA is trying to get the ISPs and hosting providers to do certain things that completely ignore all due process. And that is something which I'd be concerned about, that you draw a line very clearly that you are dealing with abuse, and what that abuse is that is criminal and not other things.
I mean, you're right to be concerned about such things. The concept is about an enabler. It doesn't say that we must give the data to J, random person who alleges there's an unlawful IP rights infringement. The concept is a model that could be equally adopted by registrars in a thin model. It could be incorporated into a contract between a CCTLD and its registrars, potentially. These are high-level concepts which are a little bit undeveloped at this stage?
Chris?
I may be confused. I've missed something. First of all, it seems to me that in most, and I accept this may not be the case in the GTLD world, but in the CCTLD world, in most CCTLDs, irrespective of whether there are registrars or not, there is a nexus, a legal nexus between the CCTLD registry or manager and the customer, because there has to be, because it's the manager who actually grants the license of the name. Unless you do it, you could, I suppose, do it by going manager, registrar, registrant, but that would mean that the rights sat with the registrar on expiry, rather than coming back
that
to the registry.
And that doesn't with us.
It doesn't work, does it? Right. So on that basis, we can say the basis upon which we will reveal your information. I think I'd actually be quite uncomfortable in Australia if registrars were in that position, because then you wouldn't have a standard practice. You'd actually have different levels of ease of dealing with authorities from one registrar and harder ones with others. So from my point of view, it's for us to do that. And your point about it's got to be crime, etc., I do accept what you say. The problem is that the moment you put something to proof, you take up a large amount of time. So the way that we deal with it is we say, it's who are you? Do we know who you are? So in the case, for example, of some of our authorities, there is a designated person or persons who can contact us and ask for information. And they have to provide us with confirmation that they're investigating something and so on. So what we won't let them do is go fishing with an F through the database just to use a quaint legal expression on a frolic of their own.
Thanks, Chris. I think that actually clarified a lot. Go ahead, Bertrand.
First of all, thank you for the panel, because it's a very interesting range of experiences. What is interesting is when we talk about CCTLDs, when we say law enforcement, there is an assumption that there is a law. And when we work in the environment of CCTLDs, although the activity covers, of course, the rest of the world, there is a close cooperation in defining the body of law at the national level to establish the balance that the local community has decided to put on the rules that will apply in case there is a breach or a misuse. I mention this because when we discuss the same thing at the global level, for GTLDs in particular, and I mentioned that as a GAC representative, because this is an idea that emerged this morning in one of the discussions. In the case of the discussion on WHOIS, for instance, for new GTLDs, thick WHOIS, thin WHOIS, it is very hard for a GAC representative that covers all ICANN issues to basically have the complete knowledge. So they are basically obliged to request their privacy commissioner at the national level and the law enforcement authority and a lot of things in order to channel back the information. And this makes me think that in terms of process, what is being done at the national level, because the actors are actually collaborating on a policy, is very difficult to do in the ICANN level because the format does not engage those actors. And so if we take an issue-based approach on who is, there is probably a need to do at the ICANN level, when we deal with those issues, mechanisms that do not necessarily force the law enforcement actors or the privacy commissioners to come to ICANN meetings, but to have a process where in between they do work together so that in the same room you have the privacy protection actors, you have the law enforcement, and they work together on the policy. And the final point is what I find extremely interesting with the CCTLD space is the demonstration that you can have a great diversity of regimes within a sort of envelope. Like, there is a big range in registration policy, in protection of data, in enforcement mechanisms. However, the whole system, on the whole, doesn't function that badly. So I want to highlight this capacity of diversity of regimes that are more adapted to the national and local behaviors.
Thank you, Bertrand. And I think yes, go ahead, Eric.
Yes, I think only three comments. The first comment is the debate for CCTLDs in Latin America in some moments and maybe for other regions is not about if a contract or not in the relation with the national laws that is the base of the contract to give something to somebody. And so with this contract is affected the registry, the registrants, and the registrar. What means that? That in, you are in contact with the courts of some country or some legislation of some country. So this is very clear. The question is, what is the thing that you give? You give a good or good a service? If you have a, you bring a thing, you can have owner rights and the property of the thing. Maybe for the domainers are interested in that kind of discussion because they want his or her domain. And for the a lot of CCTLDs, the discussion is not in that side. It's I am bringing a service and only a service, and the domain name is not a thing, it's only something. Legally, sometimes the lawyers, we make confusion in the people. And make confusion. Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. Yes, I am a lawyer too, but a good guy. We make confusion in the people because we don't clarify what is a domain name. If it's a thing, the relation is a contract, and a contract relation means some kind of rights that give to the other people, in this case, the registrant. But if not a thing, it's only a service, you can cut the service with some clause about abuse, for example. And this difference need to be in a contract. Maybe it's necessary to start that discussion. For years, nobody tried to put that discussion on the table.
Oh, Chris, come on, don't tempt us like that. That's just cruel. All right, then.
All right, then. I just thought it was rather ironic that CC people were sitting up here talking about contracts.
Thank you very much, Chris. And in fact, while we're thinking of thanks, I would like you all to join with me in giving our sincere and generous thanks to the excellent panel members we've had here in this afternoon session. Thank you all, gentlemen. Now, while we do the musical chairs, there will not be a bio break. You just have to suffer like we do. We're going to be moving straight on to protecting consumers from abuse of the DNS. Those CC presenters who are able to stay will stay, but many have other commitments. I'd like to thank you all again as you leave the room. The panel for this afternoon, and it's all going to happen magically around me while I talk on, is going to be... This is really an exercise in cruelty. This push-to-talk system is just murder. Is going to be describing the manner in which malicious abuse of the DNS affects consumers and will identify challenges for those seeking to protect consumers. Constraints defenders face, including inaccurate WHOIS data, and limitations in the current RAA agreement. The panel will then explore, if I give them time to do so, how changes in the... In fact, I will now, reading it. The RAA agreement could assist in defending consumers from abuse involving GTLDs. We have. Do we have them all yet? Have I filibustered long enough?
We've changed the order.
And thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, just as well. That's fine. Shuffling around while we're working here. We have Holly Raish, the Executive Director of the Internet Society of Australia, who is not just here as a clearly poor example of trying to get gender equity onto the panels, but is in fact here as one of the two signatories to the petition for the consumer constituency, along with Beau Brendler sitting next to her, and she is a director of the Australian Communication Consumer Action Network, a now federally funded body, which is Go Live on the 1st of July, whose task is to represent the needs of all Australian communication consumers from a tithing of funds from industry. So we are now greatly honoured to have Holly here as a peak body representative and the CEO of that organisation. We are equally delighted to announce, if you haven't noticed the buzz on the news, is Mr Alan Asher. That brings me to Beau Brendler. Beau founded a consumer protection organisation called WebWatch at Consumers Union of the US, whose family of websites included badwarebusters.org, stopbadware.org and frontgroups.org. He spent a decade in consumer advocacy on internet policy and has created widely adopted guidelines to improve website trust and credibility. We know how often he's frequently quoted because we follow him. We then have, and hopefully you boys haven't shifted. No, well done. Thank you, Dave. We then have Dave Pisticello, who is a senior security technologist with ICANN. He's recognised as expert in the fields of internet routing, broadband access and security, and more importantly, from the consumer perspective, can actually help us understand what this is all about. He does a number of briefings for us in the at-large area, and he is a genuine communicator, making complex things seem simple. Last and in no way least is Mason Cole. Mason is Vice President of Corporate Communications over C.net and also manages the company's industry relations. Previously, he worked at SnapNames, where he directed the company's public relations effort, managed relationships with ICANN and the SnapNames Partner Network. Lady and gentlemen, let's start our panel. Go ahead, Holly.
I'm not sure what slide's going to come up.
There should be a little dongle somewhere.
Somebody stole the dongle. Here we go.
That's good.
Right. Is that a dongle or is that a gizmo?
Nomenclature, you've always got to start with a definition and nomenclature. We're unsure whether it's a dongle or a gizmo, as long as it works. There we go.
Where's it going?
Well, I've never used it, but there I think that works, so just press that button.
Yep, and you're there. And this mic is on.
Oh, much better. And the next one.
You don't have to go there, just that way.
Where's the next slide? How did you make it go? Ah! It went backwards.
Shouldn't it?
That's it. No, the next slide. That's all I'm going to talk about, and I'm going to do
it. Well, that's easy.
And I'm going to do it very quickly. Basically, four topics. Basically, as outlined by Cheryl, the first is what are the actual threats, the real challenges, what's in place, and then what might be in place.
Stick there if you need to.
That's all right. Don't need it. The threats, first of all, let's start with scams. Everybody knows what a scam is, I think. It's basically you've thought you've bought the Brooklyn Bridge and you discover 3,700 people have also bought the Brooklyn Bridge and you're not likely to get your money back. But all you've done there is really lost money. The next threat, and these are all the threats that have been talked about all afternoon, so I won't spend a lot of time on them, and I will talk slowly because I suddenly realised two people look pretty frantic. Sorry, is identity theft. And identity theft means somebody can actually steal enough information about you to be you. And once they are you, they can actually make way with a lot of your property, a lot of your money, possibly a lot of your property. And the third threat actually is that sort of malware, botnet. Computers become a botnet. The most recent example in Australia was where, naturally, there's, of course, a blacklist that's developed by our regulator, and very soon after it's developed, of course, you go to WikiLeaks, and there it is. A dentist discovered his website was on the list that was blacked out. Why was this so? And basically the government had to say, well, basically his domain had been stolen. And so there went his business. People couldn't contact him. They couldn't email him. So it wasn't just his identity that was stolen. It was his business. So there are threats from a consumer point of view or from a user point of view. The challenges, and the first challenge from a consumer perspective is basically they don't understand the threats. An example I often use, we being ISOC-AU, did a series of talks about the internet. One of them was in West Australia, and there were a lot of seniors in the audience. Now, in Australia, we have a download limit that's about 3 seconds long, and it's the worst in the OECD list of countries. So if you're a senior and you are on a pension or you're a limited income and Microsoft sends out a patch and you know it's going to take a whole month's download, they don't. So they don't have the security and they don't understand the problem. The next is if you don't know, you don't care. And this is more a younger generation thing, probably anywhere from age 4 to age 45, where you will put things on Facebook or whatever, not realising or not caring, mainly not caring, about what sort of information is out there about you. A person I was talking to not that long ago basically said, you know, there's a program out there that takes about 2 minutes to come up with enough information about people so that they've got what's called a 100-point identity check. That means you can walk into a bank and you can be somebody. And that's because a lot of people put an awful lot of information about themselves out there, not particularly caring. And the third is people don't know where to go if they have a problem. Now, this was something that when Bo and I were in Mexico, was a theme, a consumer theme. Where do we go to actually start to solve things? Also, I think it was Greg, too, in a panel or so ago, basically said, look, there was an e-security week, which is true, and at the end of the session of the week, there was a little panel, and we all sat around and said, what is going to be the problem over the horizon, i.e. longer than 5 seconds? And one of the problems everyone came up with is nobody knows where there is one point to get information or some kind of reference to some other place to get the kind of information and help you need. Is it a telecommunications industry ombudsman, another kind of ombudsman? Do you go to ICANN? What is ICANN? Do you go to your registrar, your ISP? So at least some idea of where consumers go if they have a problem and how to fix it. Next heading is existing arrangements. What are they and what are the problems? First I'll start with the Registrar's Accreditation Agreement and its amendments. And some of them I actually think are very good. First of all, the resellers have been caught. They didn't used to be. Now they are, and that's a very good thing. There's a reaffirmation of the preference for the use of accredited registrars, and that's another good thing. Also, ICANN has been given some new powers to actually suspend, and the term, basically, is if there has been a fundamental and material breach. And the lawyer in me, sorry about that, doesn't see the term defined, so my brain goes, what is a fundamental immaterial breach that's going to cause some kind of response? And I really don't know. I imagine we'll find out. There's another problem, well, another issue, and that's who is data accuracy. There was a subject of an earlier workshop. The first question is, why is this data important enough to us worry about its accuracy? Unfortunately, that was asked by, I think it was a registrar. It was a very good question, and there were some people there from ICANN, and the response was something like, I will be taking instructions from my client. And while I appreciate how to make that kind of answer, I thought that wasn't good enough. You need to make people understand why it's important. So, of course, being the shy, silent type, I piped up and said law enforcement actually think it's pretty important to have that kind of data so they can actually track down some of the problems. For commercial uses, you may actually want to know how to get a hold of somebody that has a name. But also, in dispute resolution, this came up least a couple of times, if there is a dispute about a name, the people who are sitting there trying to solve it need to know who the owner is, when it was registered, when it was first registered, when it was renewed. So all of that data actually has a lot of uses, all of which are very important, and I wish somebody from ICANN had actually spoken up. There's another issue, though, and that's privacy. Now, there's all sorts of privacy regimes, and it always has to be a balance between the rights of an individual to privacy versus the need for accurate who is data. And where that balance is, I'm really not sure, but it's something that we have to work with and work through. Another issue that came up in Mexico, and to me it's still an issue, and that is the consistency of the rules. If you're going to put out information for consumers, for registrants, it ought to be consistent information. However, there's a set of rules for GTLDs, that is a set of rules that are still being developed for new GTLDs, and there's a set of rules for CCTLDs. Now, it's a confusing landscape if you don't know all of the acronyms. It's particularly confusing a landscape if you've got three sets of acronyms, you have to know what they all mean. Solutions. The first is a code of conduct. For those of you who actually do read the registrar's accreditation agreement, you'll notice there is mention of a thing called a code of conduct for registrars. You'll also notice there isn't one. That's clause 3.7 for the lawyers. I would like to see one developed, and I'd like to see one develop where the registrars sit down and say, what is best practice? And what Dave's going to talk about, which is SAC recommendation 038, would be in there, along with some others that basically say this is the best way to operate. The next one, I think, is, and it's an issue that came up in Mexico, which Bo and I also talked about, some way to quickly deal with the bad domain or main name, the criminal activity. I understand clearly there's some rules around CCTLDs and GTLDs, but a way to actually stop the activity is what we need to deal with and do that quickly and fairly, I have to say. Another solution is that sort of one portal, some way in which consumers and registrants can actually find information about what their rights are, what the obligations on registrars are, how they can actually solve their problem. Another issue, and I'll say it anyway with Dave here, is I think there's some work on compliance. I see a lot of things that are supposed to happen in the registrar's accreditation agreement. I don't see that they always happen. I'll say very little more about that. I would like to
get you out of the room.
Yeah, well, no, I'll be out of the room at 6 o'clock, trust me. One thing I would mention, and it was mentioned, I think, by, was it Greg 1 or 2? I think it was Greg 2. In Australia, the Internet Industry Association, I have to say fairly reluctantly, but nevertheless they did, has convened a working group, which we're on, to come up with a code of conduct that will help the individual consumer to understand if their computer has been compromised, how do you tell, and what do you do about it. Now, this really has only, it's been an idea, the working group hasn't been formed, so it's very early days, but it may be one, you know, another piece of the puzzle in actually dealing with DNS abuse.
Thank you, Holly, and I think we're moving straight on to Bo, providing everyone's worked out where your slides are, because when you shifted order, you also sort of shuffled the slide story as well. I think right. They're right, though.
Well,
okay.
Actually, no, I see it up
perfect.
There. So
fantastic, thank you.
In this presentation, I'm going to be drawing a little bit from some research that's been done by some other people within At Large, NewJohn, who some of you are familiar with. It's actually an At Large structure within North America. Artists Against 419, Jared Armin, and other people who deserve credit for some of the stuff I'm going to talk about. So In terms of DNS abuse, the next couple slides are going to look pretty dense, and I would refer you to the URL at the bottom if you want to look at this report in detail. It just came out last month, or at the end of May, and there's some really interesting information in there, but I think more specifically, I think it's good to note that this report was produced, in fact, by an at-large structure within the ALAC, and that group of people, along with some of the others whom I just mentioned, are beginning to take a very strong stance and role in doing some investigative work regarding some issues that pertain to abuse of the DNS and other consumer issues. So we're happy to see that evolving. Specifically on this slide, there are some significant issues, significant abuse problems at .cn. I don't know if anybody from .cn is here, but also the Chinese registrars, Xin.net, BizCN, OnlineNIC, and HiChina have frequently been cited for tolerating illicit pharmacy, software piracy, and spam, as well as for weak security that's allowed criminals from Eastern Europe and elsewhere to abuse the space. Now, this next slide is incredibly dense and violates the, whatever it is, the PowerPoint rule of three sentences or something. But so I'm certainly not going to read through all of that. Again, the URL is at the bottom. There's a couple funny ones in here. The .niue, which I assume is somewhere in the South Pacific, means nude in some languages, and illicit domainers have been using .nu to register prostitution and illegal pornography domains. .nu is administered by J. William Semich of Medfield, Massachusetts, which is a long distance from here, nowhere near Niue. Are you here by any chance, Mr. Semich? I doubt that. .ir, Iran. Iran's government-controlled ISP is hosting space for the so-called Russian Business Network. I'm waiting for them to show up to an ICANN meeting. Maybe they're here. Who knows? Maybe they're all around us. It's not clear yet how much influence they have within the CCTLD space, but New John is going to keep an eye on that. .ve, the anti-phishing working group noted in 2008, .ve not only had the most phishing domains, but highest percentage of phishing domains in relation to their portfolio. Another thing, moving more towards the positive or moving more towards solutions, within the New John report is a grid. I've kind of adapted it a little bit here and given it a rather clumsy name, problem assessment matrix, but I think it's a good tool that could be used. Maybe not for consumer education, because it may be a bit high-pitched for that, but perhaps to educate consumer groups. In essence, it's an analysis of domains within the CCTLD space, but I think it could be adapted to other areas. Responsible part, if the domain has a responsible party, public who is, and a closed registration, that's probably okay. Responsible party, private who is, closed registration, okay. And on down the list, until you see no responsible party, public who is, an open registration, bad. No responsible party, private who is, an open registration, worst. And some of the domains that, in fact, most of the domains that I just mentioned on that dense page previously are of the last item on the grid there. Now, the RAA has come up and is part of what we're supposed to be talking about here. I know that we have tried over the last year or so to require full contact information for registrars and resellers that's publicly displayed. That various bits of that made it into the RAA language at some point and then was taken out, modified, or withdrawn, but I think there is a provision in there now in the recently signed RAA that at least calls for physical address, which is good. Who is accuracy? In accordance with ongoing ICANN study, I should actually make that plural, studies, because as we know, there are a whole variety of who is studies going on now. The fruition of which we hope will be positive for consumers. And consistent with US GAO findings, the GAO estimated, I think this report is about a year or so old, but 2.31 million domain names have been registered with patently false data. Then also, defining the relationship between registrars and resellers within the RAA. We don't seem to have a lot of information about resellers, and certainly it does not appear from what we've been able to figure out, at least on the at-large side, that there's much of a contractual obligation between registrars and resellers. So we need to know more about resellers in the whole system. Consumer education challenges. I think there's a tendency to sort of say, well, you know, these this is out of scope for ICANN, or this is not our problem, or consumers need to be taught this and that. And some of that is true, but with, you know, I've had some experience in this field, about a decade of it. Consumer education is expensive and it's time consuming. The challenge of it increases with the complexity of message. And very few people outside this room, I think, even know what a CCTLD is. And if you begin to tell them those sorts of things, their eyes glaze over. Consumers are also becoming more and more accustomed to non-generative devices. I don't know if you've read Jonathan Zittrain's book, The Internet, or The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It, or some equally poetic title. But he talks about generative devices like PCs and non-generative devices. When we're expecting consumers to deal with generative devices, they come with a whole set of security issues and problems and concerns that the non-generative devices like this don't have. Consumer organizations face resource restrictions. They tend to see slices also rather than a whole pie. And then increasingly the privacy rights versus business accountability argument, I think we're tripping over a lot and have tripped over in this community for many years. And I think we need to look and be more aware of possible technological solutions to some of the WHOIS problems, although conversations I've had today have enlightened me a bit about how that may not be possible. But we'd like to know more about IRIS. We'd like to know about who in the community is studying what related to WHOIS. And I don't think that there's a real gestalt in this community right now about who's studying what about WHOIS and where those studies are going and who's doing them and what the outcome is and what the purpose and scope of them are. Actually, I'm going to skip that last slide because I used it yesterday. And we're running short of time. So do we want to see consumers avoiding doing business with private proxy registered entities? Do we want to see consumers begin to avoid doing business with entities in certain countries? Mm-hmm. Do we want to see consumers avoid doing business on the internet? I think the answer to all three of those questions is no. But given the current environment and given the direction that consumer concerns about fraud are taking, a number of research projects I undertook in the last couple of years really did show, at least in the United States, you know, 30% or more of the general populace beginning to become fearful of doing any business at all on the internet and actually decreasing their use. So we're running short. I will stop there and pass the gizmo on to Mr.
It's not a baton being handed on, it's a gizmo being handed on. Thank you, Dave.
I have to hold this down the entire time?
Yes, you do have to hold it down the entire time. It's an exercise in cruelty, and it's a way of keeping you short.
Yeah, we have
this one, by the way, won't turn off. Well,
we have several repetitive motion injuries at ICANN already. I guess I'm going to become the next victim here.
Yeah. This one will just stay on.
Oh, cool.
Now, listen, this was part of my plotting.
This is two guys with a gizmo solving the problem.
And tech people at the same table. They start talking to each other. They understand their needs.
Okay, good.
Is this obstructing or violating your space?
It's actually, you know, it's no worse than any other ergonomic environment that I occupy. So, my name is Dave Piscatello. I'm from ICANN, and this talk is actually with my ICANN Security and Stability Advisory Committee hat on. I'd like to begin by sort of giving you a picture of exactly how phishing domains are taken down by first responders, interveners, parties who work to protect brands online. I want to start a little bit before, and I know this is a little hard to read, but in the upper left-hand corner in hour 0 through 1, you have the phisher who has already found a hosting site and has uploaded some sort of phishing kit, which is essentially a web page and some clever scripting so that they can steal your identity or capture your credit card information and sell you illegal pharmaceuticals. And what they do to make it very convenient for you is they actually go and register a domain so that you can click on a URL as opposed to an IP address. They largely do this because after 10 years, people have finally realized that clicking on an IP address is not a great idea. So after the first hour, the phisher has created his site, he's registered a domain, and he sends his phishing email. Somewhere along that first hour, people begin to click the URL and visit the site. Fairly quickly, in that first hour to the 1 hour plus time frame, some anti-phishing service provider or some other monitoring organization like a brand owner is either alerted or detects that there is a phish email out there, and he wants to stop this. He needs to disable the site, and he needs to get the domain suspended. So what does he do? He needs to contact someone who knows something about that domain registration. And that's the real story behind this presentation. The most important piece of information that an intervener can find is the sponsoring registrar. This is essentially the party who is going to be integral in suspending the domain. The real important questions are, where do I find the contact information for the sponsoring registrar? And does the contact information I find lead me to someone who can handle abuse claims? So let's start with the first question. How do I find a registrar contact? Okay. You can visit the registrar's website, and we're going to think about that a little bit more in a moment. You can also visit ICANN's published list of registrar contacts, which is at this URL. And there's actually a reason why I put this here, because I'm going to give you all homework. You can ask a colleague. In fact, on many mailing lists that I participate in, we are constantly trying to help people who are looking for contact at a registrar, and we share that information. The big point here is, if you go back to that original timeline, every time an intervener can't find the registrar abuse point of contact, it extends the duration of the attack. It's minutes, hours. It really depends on how hard it is to get the information. When you get the information, you call or you make an email. Usually you try to call because that's a faster response in most cases. And you ask, can you help me? Well, it really depends on what information you obtained. And obtaining the information typically has several pitfalls. Many registrars do publish their points of contact information voluntarily. The problem is that certain published points of contact are either inaccurate or incomplete, not available 24/7, unable to handle the abuse or criminal complaints that are submitted to them. You're getting a general help desk as an example, and somebody says, oh, well, I can't do that. And Joe, who usually does that, is at Starbucks. I'm making a little bit of fun here. I don't want to do that too much, but you know that as a general contact point, it's not the same kind of person as someone whose job it is to take down sites and deal with abuse. And many of the registrars have absolutely stellar people doing this. So I don't want to paint a dark picture here. Another problem is that sometimes you hit a spot in a customer care or help desk chain where a party doesn't know how to escalate the complaint. Again, all these failures just simply add time to the duration of the attack. The site is still up, the domain is still resolving, and people are visiting the site and either being victimized by malware downloads or pharma site abuse or identity theft. I wanted to try to understand exactly how bad the situation was or how good the situation was. And I had recalled that Nujan folks had actually given a presentation at an APWG meeting, and I could not find the presentation information or the material. I should have gotten their point of contact, actually. And what I did was I visited registrar websites in search of the abuse point of contact. Now, I used the ICANN list. I went down the list for about 250, 260 sites. Out of that number of sites, I got 229 sites that resolved, and that gave me some information that I could read because some of them are in foreign languages, and I'm not real good at many Chinese and Arabic scripts. So of the sites I visited, 172 or 229 didn't have an abuse point of contact. 57 sites had some form of abuse point of contact information. 8 sites had a spam or false whois point of contact. Now, it's interesting that many people think we have 900-plus registrars. What we have is a much smaller number of registrars, and many registrars are affiliated or partners with each other. So I decided to prune this list and try to see if the numbers got any better. Instead of 75% having no abuse point of contact, 79% did. Instead of 25%, 21% did. And the reason I bring these numbers up is that there is a possibility of changing this number dramatically by simply having certain affiliate and partners just simply say, I'm going to do this. In fact, I could identify 3 to you that could almost make this 50% by the execution of one landing page. And sometimes there's a little bit of pushback, especially the registrar market, I understand, is a very competitive market. The margins are very small. But I think that there's a real incentive for registrars to distinguish themselves as being the ones who are cooperating with law enforcement, are helping consumers take down sites. And the message to those registrars who may not have the abuse point of contact is the ideal response time for phishing attacks are measured in hours. Every minute you delay extends the attack. And if you help just there by providing the right information, it's amazing how much we can reduce the delay and reduce the harm. There is an SAC report, SAC 38, which is a Registrar Abuse Point of Contacts. It's up on the SAC website. I can give you the URL if you come up to me later. And the recommendations in that site are fairly straightforward. We ask that registrars provide an abuse point of contact. That's an explicit one. But not just a contact. Someone who, a contact that actually is an effective and responsive party. Someone who can provide a complainant with a tracking system so that they can get back and say, my abuse is number 4721J. Can you tell me where you are with respect to investigating that? Publishing an abuse contact also entails making it prominent not only at the registrar site, but I think at the ICANN website, in the same way that the RIA has now asked for mandatory information for general contact information. I think that an abuse point of contact would be valuable there too. There's no real magic or science to this. The contact information should be consistent with other registration contact records, in particular because a great deal of abuse and tracking is done by automation by interveners and any phishing parties. If you can make it available in machine-readable format where you can pull it out through a whois or you can pull it out through some other vehicle, that's great too. And obviously, it would be nice if ICANN could periodically check it for accuracy. And that's it. Thank you very much.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Dave. Holly has to leave. She's hosting a function for ISOC-AU and ISOC this evening, which is off-site. So we'll forgive her for that. Thank you very much, Holly. Perhaps a little round of applause for Holly as she leaves, just to embarrass her, because if I can embarrass someone, I will, as you should all know by now. So now I'll try not to embarrass Mason. Go ahead, please.
I guess I don't get the magic constant. No, that's okay. That's okay. I only have really a few things to say. No, I'm sorry. So I did not prepare a presentation, but I see my colleague, my network solutions colleague, John Nevitt, in the room. He's just recently retired as chair of the registrar's constituency, and I'm now 24 days into my term. So it's very refreshing to John, I know, but I'm in the process of learning more about the scale of threats to the DNS that have been developing over recent years. But as I was listening to these presentations, I made a few notes, and I just wanted to share a few thoughts from the registrar's point of view.
Thanks.
Yes? Okay. So registrars obviously are interested in contributing to resolution to customer threats. We spend a great deal of time, money, effort, employee energy, marketing dollars, what have you, acquiring customers. And as it's been correctly pointed out, the registrar market is extremely competitive, and it operates on razor-thin margins, and we compete on multiple fronts, especially on price. It's very important to us that once we are successful in attracting a customer, that we do everything we can to take care of that customer, and that includes protect that customer to the extent that we can from potential harm. We don't want to lose a customer to these kinds of threats. I do want to agree with some things that Bo said about the challenges of being educated about the domain name system in general. This is my 20th ICANN meeting. I find that hard to believe, but I've been exposed to ICANN and the DNS and these types of things for some time now, and I've become literate with the terms. If I'm a registrant, I'm not near as literate. And it's most registrars that I know of, the colleagues in our constituency, do a very good job of educating customers about how to go about the process of taking care of getting a domain name, taking care of it, and protecting it. Can we do better? Sure. There's always room for improvement. Remarkably, this is still a young industry. I agree with Bo that it's complex. It will be complex for a while until efficiencies continue to introduce themselves into the marketplace to make things simpler. But as registrars, we are very interested in taking care of the customer and making sure that the customer understands what's happening. A word about the RAA. I agree. The RAA, the update has been very useful. The amendments that were just put into place, registrars agree that they were necessary. We embrace them. We wanted very much to have the playing field leveled, and we wanted to have the RAA available to us as a tool to help root out bad actors. I'm probably going to disagree with several folks that the RAA should be used as a continual policy development tool. We have a policy development process in place that can be used for that purpose. And a word also about best practices. Registrars are very interested in best practices. We're interested in developing them, encouraging them, and using those as another method for rooting out bad actors. Do you hear a theme in here? We want to root out bad actors. So I want that known. Other than that, I think I'm going to stop there. So I look forward to this discussion. Thank you.
Thank you, Mason. And I must say, coming from the somewhat more unique Australian experience, where we set up an industry code of conduct which is enforced by AUDA, but was actually an industry self-regulation model, and having been one of the consumer reps on that, the discovery that, in fact, we do all want the same end game is one that, you know, the consumers tend to go, oh, you mean you're not all bad guys? And the industry goes, well, of course not. It doesn't do us any good for one bad apple to spoil the barrel at all. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm happy to open up the floor now for questions. So if anyone would like to come down and raise a question to who's left of the panel, then please do so. Come on down.
I seem to be going up and down here quite a bit this afternoon. Just one thing that does concern me a small bit is the constant reference to the Neutron reports. I know that at one of the recent RIPE meetings, and I think it might have been in Amsterdam, Neutron put forward one of their presentations and were referring specifically to Whois accuracy. And the critique that they had was not that the Whois data was incomplete, but that it was in a language and script that they could not understand. And that based on that single criterion, the Whois data provided was inaccurate and therefore abusive. And Neutron have a terrible tendency to throw out these wonderfully broad sweeping statements about companies and individuals without, you know, having any real tangible data. And I just think it's a bit dangerous to rely so much on their reports.
May I speak to that, Cheryl?
And I actually wonder whether Dave might also want to follow up with the internationalized and data registry as well. Go on.
Sure. Yeah, I agree with Michaela. I'm afraid that is the case. In our experience, we have found even in we've seen the Neutron reports. We investigated them, and we did find that they were unfortunately quite inaccurate. If there is reporting to be done about the state of any point of technology in that has to do with registrar operations, we're happy to make sure that whatever data is necessary to help inform people is accurate, and we'll contribute to that process. I agree that it's disturbing when factually inaccurate information is made revealed to the public in a way that creates confusion about the real situation.
I can't sit here and necessarily defend the depth or validity of Nugent's research in every case. The information I was quoting from the May report, what I think is interesting is that we have an at-large structure within ICANN that is taking the time to do this kind of research, and I think, knowing Nugent as I do, they would be somewhat open and welcome to working with anyone who wanted to work with them. But, I mean, the point is whenever we see data that we don't necessarily like to see or that doesn't come from our particular perspective, I think we have a tendency to react poorly to it, especially given the way it may be released. From a journalistic perspective, not that Nugent is necessarily referring to itself as a journalistic entity, but when you release a report on something, or when you do reporting on something, you don't run it by the people who may have a vested interest in how the data appears in order to make sure that they think it's okay or not. So that's probably not going to happen. And I wouldn't encourage it to happen necessarily, but I would encourage you to get in touch with Garth and some of the other folks who I cited at the beginning as doing some of this research, because no one else is really doing it. I mean, is there anything out there that anybody has on hand about the CCNSO?
Yeah, there is. I mean, I think...
So I'm not going to spend time defending Garth, and I think I think that there are certainly points at which you can take issue with some of his reports, and that's duly noted. You're not going to see those cited chapter and verse in an ESSAC report, I guarantee you. There are, however, other extremely reliable sources that I will be happy to share with you. I think the University of Alabama Birmingham spam data mine is fabulous. I think the Shadow Server Foundation folks are really, really rock solid. There are other people who are the NCFTA are doing some great monitoring collection. Surveillance. The list goes on and on and on.
APWG,
Spam House. But even just to give people an idea that there is a lot of information out there, I'm not going to point at any registrars, but if you go back and you look at Bo's slides and you look at the names of some of the registrars there, you will find them at the same prevalence on the same lists. And if you notice that the registrars that are in this room are usually not at the top of that list, and that's because these are the good guys. These are the guys who really are trying to make a difference, and they end up getting hammered. And my goal, my objective in trying to put these kinds of recommendations, and I think it holds for the entire ESSAC, in front of the registrar community, is to help the registrars that really want to do a good job distinguish themselves markedly from the people who are not, because consumers understand that. And so, we're talking about things like trust marks for, that registrars might be able to, obtain from ICANN or a trusted third party that illustrate that they meet a certain criteria and they're implementing a baseline that consumers can trust. And so the same way that a consumer will go and see the VeriSign SSL trust mark or the Thought SSL trust mark or a consumer reports trust mark, and they'll use that site. We can slowly migrate people away to the point where it's very obvious when somebody has 99% of their portfolio as spammy and fishy domains, and maybe at that point, with a little bit more in the hands of compliance and a little bit more of a pit bull mentality, we can take some of these folks and we can put them out of business. I have no goal. There's nothing that I want more than to make the industry really reputable and to make people just feel really confident about going to the registrars that ICANN accredits and making a transaction and knowing that that they're safe. I mean, that's part of my job.
Mason?
So I want to speak to both those points. I certainly don't want to beat up on Bo because his work is always very good. On the issue of Nujan, here's the problem. When inaccurate data is provided to the marketplace without being verified for its accuracy, then registrars who are affected by that find themselves in a position where they have to defend themselves to their customers on data that is inaccurate. Or they have to defend themselves to newspaper reporters or what have you, when the premise of the thought is incorrect to begin with. Now, I'm a former journalist myself, and it was my duty to, when I was reporting on any situation, to contact the affected entity and verify, or at least get an opposite point of view. If anyone wants to report on this industry, no objection. But if you do report, it's incumbent to make sure that the data is accurate. So, you want to say?
Yeah, I understand that, and I'm not from Nujan, but I guess what I would say again is, Nujan is part of the ICANN community now. They're an at-large structure within ICANN. So work with them, talk to them. You know,
Help them get their work better. I think this is the subtext.
Yeah, we've made that outreach. So, and then I want to speak to what Dave said too. I think registrars would applaud any kind of effort to generally make it known, and we do this actually in our own marketing. We want to make sure that registrants who are looking for a safe place to do business are aware of those safe places to do business. And I know that the registrar that I represent goes out of its way to be known as a security-conscious registrar. And so whatever we can do in our constituency to encourage our colleagues to do the same, then we certainly will.
I thought you wanted to write a reply, but you've ceded to Nigel, or you want a second point?
No, I think it's fine. The main thing is that, you know, I appreciate that Bo's report and everything else is, you know, it's in the right place. The heart's in the right place and everything else. Just I had an issue, as Mason has as well, with how certain things were put forward.
And I'm going to take my role here to say, and it sounds like we also maybe are able to find ways forward to better, more satisfying partnership relationships. Go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you. Nigel Roberts from .gg. I take great comfort from what Mason said about if you're going to say something about somebody, you better be accurate. I do, however, take issue with Mr. Brendler. His presentation contained certain implications and close to allegations regarding a couple of members of the CCTLD community.
Yeah.
You essentially said that Bill Semich of .nu was involved in child pornography because you used the word illegal pornography, did you not?
No.
Okay, then. Maybe I misunderstood. Can we have the slide back and then I can see what it is?
Can we bring back the slide? Thank you.
And you said, is he here? I think not. Well, I saw him in the corridor a couple of days ago.
Great.
Mr. Semich has been coming to ICANN meetings since before there was an ICANN meeting. If you're going to excoriate a member of our community, then I think it behooves you to send a courtesy email before you do so and tell him that, and maybe he would have been here. I don't know if he's still here or if he's left. But the ad hominem nature of your presentation, I found a little bit incorrect.
I think all we can say to that is so noted, but we can give Bo the clarity to say what he said to ensure that there is no error and implied.
There is a phrase I remember, illegal pornography. You mentioned Iran. Now, I have a pretty...
There's no reference to child pornography, as you stated.
Okay,
I believe you said child pornography. That's not...
But to my mind, illegal pornography and child pornography are faintly synonymous, but that's, you know, it's my perception.
That's
illegality is still illegality, whatever the kind of illegality it is. So
I think the point of all of this is not, you know, when I said, is Mr. Semich here, I mean, I think perhaps the reference to... I think it's a bit odd in your community in certain circumstances, or at least it would look odd to consumers, that country code domains, even though they are the sovereign property of the countries, can be, in essence, sold off to whomever pays the country enough money to do whatever they want to do with them. I cite Moldova as another example, as being run out of New Jersey.
I mean, this is an entirely, completely different debate regarding the nature of what a two-letter identifier on the internet actually is and what the authority of anybody running a CCTLD code or indeed ICANN is in legal terms. This is there's a PhD in that somewhere. So when you say it's sovereign property, there's a whole debate around the origin of authority for any TLD on the internet that was created prior to ICANN. So let's not open
and,
that
and
can
it's
of
also worms, remember, please. Nigel, that this afternoon's panel was put together to look at things very much from a consumer perspective, and consumers have not been well informed and in fact would find it extremely difficult and probably fairly off-putting to try and become better informed. What I can say is when a consumer wants to look at something that they assume belongs to X because of the implied ownership of X and it ends up being B, they get nervous. And if we've done nothing more than heighten that as an awareness on all sides, well, that's not a bad thing.
Indeed, and I accept that.
Can I
find it
here,
curious
Michael?
For when we're talking about internet privacy and rights that Mr. Semich's home address is put up there, literally millimetres away from the words illegal pornography. I think if you have evidence of the fact, I think you should report that to the relevant authorities in Massachusetts and see him prosecuted. But I don't think that's going to happen because these allegations have been around ad hominem for a long time. It's not my job to defend him.
Yeah,
you know, I run a completely different CCTLD.
But it is my job to control the management of this meeting, and I have, I think, out of courtesy, because it is an important topic and we do need to be fair, let that particular subject run long enough. Go ahead, Philip.
Philip Argy, argystar.com, something a little more prosaic, perhaps. The suggestion earlier that we have a one-stop shop is really important for consumers, and I'm wondering if we can't really simplify this by having a global convention, for example, that abuse at domain name will always be automatically directed to one or more relevant law enforcement agencies, registrars, CCTLDs, so that consumers know if they receive a phish, all they've got to do is send it as an attachment to abuse at domain name, and somebody who is understanding of this stuff, which is about the level at which consumers perceive it, will deal with it appropriately. I mean, something that facile needs to be done. I mean, we can do a whole lot more sophisticated stuff, but just something like that would be good. I mean, in Australia, we have a spam reporting mechanism to a regulator, but I'm told that regulator only looks at those emails every couple of days and looks at to enforce the Spam Act and doesn't refer on phishes that come in the form of spam. That, to me, is absurd. I mean, total fragmentation of effort and waste of effort on the part of those who report them.
So there actually is a mail convention, and it's documented in an RFC, and it actually strongly recommends the use of abuse at, admin at, and things like that. And the SAC 38 report actually suggests that we have a uniform convention for exactly that purpose. Gets a little trickier when you start to use web pages and web forms, and you have people with Drupal and people with other automatic page and content generation, so names don't get quite so easily generated, and I don't want to put unreasonable onus and make people actually alter from their web generation and content generation to make some things as clear as they might be. I do think that that it is valuable to have to have some uniform notion of abuse, and that whether it's an ISP or it's a CCTLD registry or a GTLD registry or a registrar that serves any of them, you can contact them all with the relatively same convention, and that's I think very valuable. Yeah.
Any further questions or comments to the microphone? If not, I'd like to share something with you. While we've been sitting here this afternoon, and those of you who are in the Internet Governance Forum will know there's at least three pieces of social networking software open on my computer as well as so I can see these slides, I've been watching a little discussion go on about the fact that well, there was just about a meltdown in the Australia Post call centres this afternoon because I happened to be 9 hours into a phishing attack based on your slide. I might share this URL now, it's gone public, but Josh Rowe, who is involved in AUDA, has been keeping me up to date on what up until now has been confidential, but I think it's, as he does, slightly ironic when our Australia Post server has been busy being fished while we've been sitting here talking about the risks to consumers. Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to thank what's left of the panel for, I think, a healthy and spirited debate. I think we've learnt a lot. I think we continue to need to learn a lot. And I'm pretty darn certain that we'll get a lot further together than we will in opposition. And I don't know about everyone else in this room, but I'd like to give each and every one of these panellists, both here and those that have left, a rousing applause. In absolute closure, however, it's important that we work out whether or not this type of exercise is worthy of your time and our energy. Therefore, feedback, comments, indications on whether or not you'd like to see this sort of thing again is going to be called for. And again, with this social networking that we're doing, I've been frantically typing to and from staff, and I gather that in the next few days there will be some form of wiki, suggestion box, comment space, etc., that we'll put out to the community. And most importantly, that all the slides that have been used here today, perhaps with some edits, will be available in the next few days on this meeting space. Margie, did you wish me to cover anything else or say anything? Wave, yell, talk?
Yeah, thank you. We will follow up, post the slides, and try to get a wiki page up to solicit input from the community. Thank you, everyone.
And I promised the translators and the scribes that it would be a 18-20 finish, but as you walk out, think about the work they do, and I want to thank you all from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, and thank you again.